Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello from Munich. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by Kraken, which is the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Jimmy Song discussing the blockchain myth, which we recorded when we were out in Oslo. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So firstly, I need to introduce a new sponsor, Acointing, a crypto tax tool, which also includes portfolio management. So I've been talking to the team about this for a while now, for a couple of months. I met up with them in Consensus in New York, and they demoed me the product and agreed to sponsor podcasts, which is pretty cool. So firstly, just a big thanks to them for agreeing to do this. And when I got back to England, I had the chance to finally play with the software, and it's super impressive. The first thing they absolutely nail, which is something that's really important to me, is they kill the UX. The UX is amazing. It's so easy to use, especially with something like tax, which is so complicated. They absolutely nail it. You'll see when you download it, when you check it out, you'll see how easy it is to use. But it doesn't just calculate your tax. It optimizes your trading decisions to ensure that you trade the right coins to reduce your tax burden. You can also import data from every major exchange and every wallet provider. And the product is so reasonably priced. They do have a free option, but the basic option is $129, and you can report up to 5,000 trades, and they have an unlimited trades option for $259. You definitely need to check this out. If you want to be reporting your tax correctly, you've got to give Acointing a go. So go and check it out. It's at acointing.com, which is acointing.com. Next up, my favorite wallet provider, Dropbit. I've been working with these guys for a couple of months now. You keep hearing me talking about them. I keep bringing them up. They don't just sponsor the podcast. They also put on events for me, which is super cool. A chance to get a bunch of people together to talk Bitcoin and to send each other Bitcoin. So they sponsored my event at New York at Consensus. They've now agreed to sponsor another event at Bitcoin 2019 in San Francisco, which I will be emceeing. So if you want to come to that, let me know. I'll put you on the guest list. But yeah, I've been using it loads. I've been showing people the wallet. I've been getting people to download it. I think I've given away about $2,000 with it now and done about 50 transfers. Gotta say, I love it. Just like my previous sponsor, as I mentioned, I love UX, and they absolutely nail the UX. Dropbit is like Venmo for Bitcoin. It's so easy to use, and it's definitely changed the way I use Bitcoin. So if you want to check it out, head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. Okay, so on to my interview with Jimmy, and this is an interview me and him have been talking about for a few weeks now. He wrote this article that's up on his Medium about why blockchain is not the answer. Definitely check it out. It's included in the show notes. The article discusses the myth of the blockchain and how decentralization is not going to be the answer for every single business problem. So it was a fitting time to record out in Oslo. We were both out there for the Freedom Forum hosted by the Human Rights Foundation. And yeah, you know, it was one of those things as well as meeting people. I definitely found people who are interested in Bitcoin, but I was also meeting people asking me about blockchain, asking me about Ethereum, telling me about blockchain for social good, you know, all those kind of things that are maybe using that blockchain myth. So it was a great time to record it. I was glad to do it with Jimmy. And yeah, we got into the details. He told me about the article. He explains what a blockchain is, why Bitcoin has value, and some of the problems with these other blockchains. And specifically, we kind of get into Ethereum and how that might play out. But it was super cool. Really glad to record it with Jimmy. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it. If you've got any comments, let me know. Just a few notes on events. I'm in Munich right now. I had an amazing time at the Lightning Hack Day. Met a whole bunch of cool people there. It's really interesting. When you go to these events, you realize crypto Twitter is very different from the real world. People are talking about different things. I also had the Value of Bitcoin conference today, which was super cool as well. I'm going to be emceeing the Crypto Compare Digital Asset Summit, which is on the 12th of June in London. The event features a great lineup of speakers, including Andreas Antonopoulos, Tom Lee, Melton Demures, Gabor Gabax of Van Eck. So it's going to be a really cool event. Tickets are still available at the moment, and they've created a discount code if you want to go. If you use WBD, you can get 20% off your tickets. Attendees can register at summit.cryptocompare.com, and they are also taking payments in Bitcoin and ETH. Also, next month, I'm going to be heading back to the States, got a whole bunch of interviews planned, and I'm going to be ending up in San Francisco for Bitcoin 2019, which I'm going to be emceeing, which is also going to be great. So looking forward to that. And listen, if you want to support the show, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. Just head over to my website, which is whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section, it'll explain everything you can do. And I do have to give a massive thank you out to my top tier patron, Rise Wallet. They're a new way into Bitcoin. There are no signups. You just scan the card and you are holding Bitcoin. To find out more, head over to risewallet.com. Okay, so onto the interview. Like I say, if you've got any questions, you know my email. Well, if you don't, it's hello at whatbitcoindid.com, and I can't wait to hear from you. Morning, Jimmy.
Morning, Pete.
So we're here in Oslo at the Freedom Forum. How have you found it? Because like me, you go to a lot of conferences.
Yeah, I do. And most of them are Bitcoin conferences. I'm finding this one a lot of fun in many ways. First of all, they know how to party. I don't know if you've been to a lot of the late night stuff, but it's a lot of fun. Not to say that, you know, Bitcoiners don't know how to party, but it's a different kind. The male-female ratio is a lot different at these things.
Very different.
Very different. The, you know, just there's people from all over the world, not necessarily just whoever happens to be like within a 500-mile radius. I'm actually going to the talks, which is different because I don't know about a lot of, you know, human freedom issues, and there's some that I vehemently agree with, others that I vehemently disagree with. So it's been great.
I also found quite interesting is that a lot of the talks were quite short and left you with just very key points to take away rather than like a huge discussion where you have to go away and do your research. You just kind of got the impression, okay, China's bad. A lot of people are living under authoritarian regimes. You know, you got these very key takeaways, and I thought that was quite useful.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a lot different than, say, a technical talk or an ICO presentation or something like that. You know, one feels a little too complicated, another feels like too snake oily. Here, it's just, you know, they drill down their message and make it much easier for you to swallow and understand. Now, there's definitely subtleties to all of these issues. And if you talk to some of these presenters, you get that. But I like how they distill the message in a way that that's easily swallowable, at least at first glance.
Yeah. I'll tell you another good thing is because we obviously spoke in advance about doing this interview about the myth of the blockchain. Mm-hmm. You wrote your article on Medium. Mm-hmm. And it's very good timing, actually. It's a stark reminder coming to this because there's been a lot of Bitcoin talks. But at the same time, I've had people come to me saying, oh, so you work in blockchain. Mm-hmm. Or I met somebody who's working on a project. And she said, we've got a blockchain project, blockchain for good. So I found myself reiterating that you need to be very careful about what you think a blockchain can do. I guess I'm not as firm as you in terms of my kind of maximalist approach to Bitcoin. But at the same time, I'm pretty much there. But it's been a stark reminder that there's so many people when they come in at the edge, they have this broad cryptocurrency market to navigate and try and understand, which is very hard.
It is very hard. And this is one of the things that, you know, your podcast obviously is trying to help people navigate. I had breakfast this morning with a bunch of the Freedom Fellows. These are basically activists all around the world. They basically kind of won like a scholarship from the Human Rights Foundation. And part of what I wanted to do was teach them about Bitcoin and financial freedom. And, you know, they're often working in oppressive regimes. And I was telling them, well, you know, if you need to get your money over to your operatives, then Bitcoin might be a pretty good choice. And, you know, describing some of it. And then somebody raises their hand and they're like, hey, so there's this blockchain project that, you know, one of my friends told me about, and you know, it's you know, I can blog something, and you know, it'll be on the blockchain, and it'll make sure to pay the author every time somebody reads it or something. And I'm like, oh god, I just straight up explain, you know, like most of these things are scams, and whether they know it, whether the creators know it or not, and there's a tendency for the word blockchain to be used to sell almost anything, right? Like, oh, you have this problem? Yeah, blockchain will solve it. It's become this like panacea for everything.
Well, this is where one of these Twitter arguments started, whereby I was trying to make a point to people that I always try and think of, I don't try and think of the people already in who understand it. Mm. And there's a lot of people who know better who still believe in other cryptocurrencies and other blockchain-based projects. But I always try and say, look, people coming in, this is really hard to navigate. Mm. You know, you could tell somebody about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. They could go to Coinbase and they're going to see Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash. And they've got no way of knowing that Bitcoin is a true Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash is nonsense. And I don't think we've still crystallized a way of explaining this simply to people, why they should focus on Bitcoin and why they should forget about blockchains. But you've done an article about it. Mm-hmm. So let's approach it from the simple angle first. Imagine somebody, this is the first podcast they've ever listened to.
Okay.
First one, tell them what a blockchain is.
Well, blockchain is really a very specific set of technologies that basically power Bitcoin. And when you think about Bitcoin, assuming that somebody that's coming in that doesn't really know what Bitcoin is, the easiest way that I've found to explain it is explaining it as decentralized digital scarcity. Now, those words might seem a little bit intimidating, but if you think about centralized scarcity, it's just scarcity that's controlled by a central party. So Mickey Mantle baseball cards, Chanel handbags, and concert tickets are all centralized scarcity. It's issued by somebody, and for all you know, they can issue more without needing your permission. They're also a big source of knockoffs because it's relatively easy to produce and try to imitate at a much lower cost than their actual value relative to that scarcity. Now, decentralized scarcity is something like gold, or in the past, something like salt or wampums that were used by Native Americans in America. Those are all things that sort of occur in nature. And in principle, you don't need anybody's permission, and anyone can try to go gather some of that stuff. Turns out to be hard because it's actually scarce. It's actually rare, and you can't just produce any more of it. What Bitcoin is it's decentralized digital scarcity. We didn't really know that was even possible because everything on the digital realm, there doesn't seem to be something that's really kind of natural, kind of like gold, wampums, or salt that you can grab. But it turns out math is actually natural, and that's the brilliance of Bitcoin and what Satoshi created. So when you're thinking about Bitcoin, you really have to think in monetary terms. And the things that are important in monetary terms are that it doesn't really change, right? You want predictability. You want a stable base. I call it sort of the base layer of civilization. And you want that to be stable, not moving or changing around all the time. Otherwise, you'd be destabilizing everything else. And second, you want to be very careful with it. It has to be absolutely solid technology, because if anything is broken or exploitable in it, then people will take advantage of it. So that's what the blockchain stack is. It's a particular set of technologies that makes coordination expensive, and building on it relatively easy because it's so solid and doesn't change very often. And when people are talking about the word blockchain, they don't seem to really get that that's what the purpose is, and they seem to sort of impute on it whatever qualities that they want.
So why do you think people are using blockchains, mm-hmm. and not just the term, but actually building blockchains, whether it is decentralized or whether it is permission blockchains or corporate blockchains? Why do you think people are doing this? I don't believe in every instance it's just a marketing term, but why do you think people believe they've got something different than just a database?
Yeah, first of all, it definitely is a database, and it's a subset of a database. It's just arranged in a particular way. The word blockchain comes from, a chain of blocks. Every block points to a previous block. So it's literally a linked list of blocks from a computer science perspective. And all of that has data that's verifiable and so on. The reason why the word blockchain has sort of taken on a life of its own is because right around 2014, 2015, a lot of people were noticing Bitcoin, especially like the rise in late 2013 brought a lot of media attention and a lot of people were looking at it. And suddenly people were saying stuff like, well, I believe in the technology, but I don't believe in Bitcoin. And that was a way to sort of distance themselves from sort of the seedy reputation that Bitcoin had. You have to remember in October of 2013 was when Ross Ulbricht was arrested and the Silk Road was taken down. It was also when a lot of people went to Bitcoin on Backpage. Very kind of seedy magazine in the U.S. And a lot of other things that were associated with Bitcoin that were sort of not for kids, as I would say. So a lot of people wanted to get. They were trying to figure out what made Bitcoin special, and they came to the conclusion of, oh, it must be the technology. And I kind of blame a lot of Silicon Valley and people like Don Tapscott for this, right? He wrote the book The Blockchain Revolution, and he made the case that blockchain is going to change everything, that it's this magical thing that will make everything perfect somehow. And that vision got basically sold to everybody. And it took on a life of its own very soon afterwards. And I think that's how it happened. I don't know. It's hard to say what went on in the minds of MBAs everywhere, but that's what it seemed like to me.
Was there ever a time yourself where you thought a blockchain could do more than just Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I worked for a couple of years trying to make a blockchain work. But what I realized is like it's kind of an impossibility. The best you can do is something federated, and that's essentially what sidechains is doing. The Liquid sidechain by Blockstream is doing. And I think in that particular case, the trade-off makes sense because. It's still centralized, it's federated, but you get all sorts of privacy properties as a result in that trade-off. So you lose decentralization, but you also gain privacy almost completely. So the only choice is if it does ever become a choke point, then the entire thing has to be shut down. You can't selectively ban transactions or something like that. So that's one aspect of it. But really, I did try for a couple of years trying to make something work based on quote unquote blockchain technology. What I found, and I did study a lot of the other tech, including something like IBM Hyperledger, is that you almost always end up like if you want to make money, you're going to need some centralized component. And oftentimes you need that anyway, just because of the regulatory requirements and compliance requirements. So in the end, it's like, well, then why are we making this really slow and expensive and, hard to maintain and hard to upgrade database if we're going to, have a centralized point of failure anyway. So in the end, I tried to make it work and it didn't. And I do understand the perspective where people are coming in and getting excited about the possibility. They just haven't worked it out yet. And they haven't come to the realization, well, okay, we can't, this can't work, right? Like that's the key thing.
So it's only good for money and only good for money in the instance of probably Bitcoin.
Yeah, at least that's the conclusion I've come to. It's possible you could use it for something else, but...
Well, we had the Microsoft announcement. That seems very interesting.
Yeah, so I think the way they're doing it is they're anchoring on the Bitcoin blockchain. So It turns out that building something decentralized is really, really hard. And people throw around the word decentralization like it's something that you can just kind of conjure up very easily. But you have to remember that Bitcoin kind of had an immaculate birth, right? It was the first, and Satoshi kind of disappeared. Those two facts are not common in anything. And it's the first is certainly not true of any other cryptocurrency afterwards. And the second is not true of almost every other coin. I think Monero might be the only one where the creator has disappeared, something like that.
And perhaps Grin.
Yeah. Yeah. So, arguably, a lot of the people are still at least around.
Yeah.
But creating decentralization where there's no single point of failure, especially from a development perspective, ends up becoming really, really difficult. And you could see this in like projects like Ethereum, where you have Vitalik basically having the last say, right? He's kind of benevolent dictator for life. And this is the case for almost every open source project. It's very hard to have software that's upgraded in a coordinated way that's decentralized. Because Satoshi left, what you have in Bitcoin Core is a ton of people that are doing things at kind of a consensus level. And the one developer that tried to take the title of benevolent dictator for life was Gavin Andreessen. And he got, a lot of developers did not like that because that they knew what a threat that would be to what Bitcoin was. So in many ways, when you look at something like Bitcoin Cash, what's happened is, well, they still have to deal with the coordination problem, and they centered that around Amaury Sachet. So he's now pretty much benevolent dictator for life for BCH. And of course, Craig Wright didn't like that. So now, Bitcoin SV, he's the benevolent dictator for life in Bitcoin SV. So, people act like decentralization is easy to achieve. I really haven't seen it in anything but Bitcoin. So, blockchain technology could be useful if you can also achieve decentralization with it. It's one of the requirements, but it's not a sufficient condition. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't really get yet.
But people will say, Jimmy, that Bitcoin is MySpace. It's slow. It's got a 7 transactions per second limit, uh-huh, or whatever it's at. Uh-huh. What is your answer to that? Because there are blockchains out there, uh-huh, which are faster, mm-hmm, that can hold more data. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the speed. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why is 10 minutes important?
Well, so you need, for the coordination aspect, essentially. So you need every node to be able to be sort of in sync with what the current state of the ledger is. Obviously, if it wasn't, then, one node might be saying, okay, this payment is good. Another might be saying it's not. That coordination is an essential part of the ledger and an essential part of the decentralization. If one's saying one thing and another saying another, you have a problem, right? You need to be able to resolve who's right. And proof of work is actually the way you're supposed to do it. And if one has more proof of work, then you decide, okay, well, that's an objective, nicely objective standard. Almost every other consensus algorithm that I've looked at, it's either really subjective, requires trust, or in which case it's not Byzantine fault tolerant. But there's all sorts of problems with these consensus algorithms, not necessarily because they don't work. I mean, if you have the right assumptions, of course they work. It's just that they're not decentralized in any way. It's just, okay, well, if most of us think that it should go that way, none of those kinds of consensus algorithms ever survive something like what happened with 2x, right? Like where the businesses were like, oh, we're going to go this way. In any scenario where you had something other than proof of work, the businesses would have won. And so when I think about the transaction speed and things like that, I honestly don't pay attention to those criticisms that much, because in a way they're solving for something that's not really a problem right now.
But it's a term people will be sucked into. Uh-huh. Someone new might come in here, uh-huh, oh, but Bitcoin is slow and it's not scaling. And, we've got this other blockchain that's fast. And so how do you convince them that, mm-hmm, these aren't important factors?
Well, so I ask, well, what's the value of Bitcoin? Right? And this gets into a much deeper topic, which is, what is money and what's the utility of money? And this is a really deeply philosophical and almost like at a core human question. And I've thought about this quite a bit. And really, if you don't come to the conclusion that it's mainly the main value is as a store of value, that it can store value in an effective way over time, versus almost anything else. If you don't come to that conclusion, you probably shouldn't buy Bitcoin, right? And I'm not even sure you should buy any other cryptocurrency, because if you're using method of payment, almost everything is better, and there's all sorts of other things that are way more convenient, way faster, way easier to use. If you go to China, WeChat, you can pay everyone with WeChat or whatever. That's way more convenient and way more transactions per second, and it's certainly centralized, but so are all these other cryptocurrencies. So it doesn't really matter. You have to learn what it is that you, the value you actually see in Bitcoin. And if you don't see the store of value, then it's going to be hard for you to understand why, transactions per second aren't important. Now, there are people like Roger Ver going around saying, we can do, X transactions per second, except, it doesn't matter if there's nobody want, you can make a really wide lane road, but nobody wants to go where you're going. So it doesn't really matter.
Okay. So let's look at Ethereum, because You've obviously got your bet, incoming bet with Joe. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've often thought about and I've raised a number of times is, how can so many people be wrong? Mm. How can there be so many developers interested, so many investors interested, so many people building things, and then they be wrong? That's the first thing I think of. Mm-hmm. The next thing I think of is, when I look at it myself, just trying to be as objective as I can, I just keep thinking, what solution are you providing that anyone cares about?
Uh-huh.
And how can this possibly scale?
Yeah.
So it seems kind of obvious to me,
uh-huh,
but at the same time, how can so many people be wrong?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people have been wrong about a lot of things, right? And this has been true in, throughout history about a lot of different things, including scientific breakthroughs. And there's a particular view of scientific history which says that, you need a bunch of people to die off first before you make some progress. I think the germ theory, at the time, there were a bunch of older doctors that just refused to wash their hands. They just didn't believe in it. And it took them dying off before, germ theory really caught on. And we know germ theory is right. It's how could so many of those people be wrong? Well, they were stubborn. They were prideful. I don't know. There's probably sociological reasons. They're probably, reasons related to their status or position or whatever. But for whatever reason, it's very possible for a lot of people to be wrong. We also know that the Wright brothers were a very independent shop with a very tiny budget. At the same time that they were doing something, there was a whole government-funded effort to try to make man-made flying machines. And they were spectacularly unsuccessful. And they spent way too much money. They had a lot more press. But they were all wrong, right? A lot more people went towards that. But rightness and wrongness and crowd, how many people are in each crowd, they don't necessarily correlate. We tend to think they have to, because we're so used to a democracy, right? It's it's kind of majority means that it's right, kind of relative thinking. But that's not how truth is arrived at. So that's one part of the question, which is about how could so many people be wrong. As far as the actual things that Ethereum provides, you're absolutely right. There's nothing really that Ethereum provides other than a platform for ICOs. And really, that's launching other scams, as far as I can tell.
I would throw a platform for stablecoins as well.
It could be. And you could do a fully backed stablecoin. I still don't understand why they need to be on any sort of blockchain. You can do the same thing from a freaking website with a centralized database just fine, because you need to look up, how many coins here are there or whatever. I guess people like having the infrastructure in place already and sort of the pseudo regulatory dodging that you can kind of do with that. But you know, that's sort of a legal murky area. As far as the you know, ICOs and the killer app on Ethereum is the ability to launch ICOs. And ICOs are just a way of printing your own money. So it's you know, the ability to create money printing machines and the ability to then print money at your own leisure, which is essentially what people have been doing.
Okay, so a fair question here then would be Samson, who I'm mm-hmm. going to be speaking to, has just announced his project, and he's going to be launching an STO on the Bitcoin blockchain.
I think on Liquid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you see that having the same problems or different problems?
Yeah, so he's doing it on Liquid, and so security tokens are kind of weird, right? And I speak from my first experience as a Bitcoin developer being on the Color Coins project, which is essentially kind of like, what, at least when I was developing it, I was always thinking like security token-ish things or bonds or something like that. Stuff that was backed by something. ICOs, on the other hand, they're backed by nothing. I never thought that would ever take off because why would you buy something that's backed by nothing? I don't know, but somehow—
People are still doing it.
Yeah, I guess I underestimated the marketing brilliance of Vitalik and friends, but that's essentially what it's become. You know, security tokens, I can see a platform like that working. The regulatory hurdles, though, are what make it very kind of iffy for me. If it is a security token, then there's a company that backs it. But at the same time, I mean, how are regulators going to look at that? Especially if it's on Liquid, the assets are confidential, the amounts are confidential. You have no idea who you're sending it to. Everything is private.
Yeah,
and that's not something that regulators generally like, especially with respect to, you know, ownership of companies and things.
Next up, I talked to Jimmy more about blockchains, and we also have a bit of a chat about Craig Wright. But before that, I do have a message from my show sponsors, Sir Kraken. How often do I have to tell you how much I love these guys? And yes, they're a sponsor, so I have to love them, right? But no, I love them for everything they're doing. I was actually today with Trace Mayer. I bumped into him at the Value of Bitcoin conference in Munich. We were talking about Kraken. We were talking about the culture of the business. We're talking about the team. We're talking about how they're trying to create more than just an exchange which just takes your money. They're trying to create something which represents the soul of Bitcoin and crypto. So yeah, love working with them. It is now the only place I buy and sell Bitcoin. And as I mentioned last week, they had a big announcement. They're raising money. They're giving people the opportunity to invest in Kraken. Via Bank to the Future, investors can invest in a future Kraken with a minimum investment amount of $1,000. If you want to find out more about that, if you are interested in investing in Kraken, just head over to banktothefuture.com, which is banktothefuture.com. Also, loads of cool stuff coming up. I've been seeing loads of the product updates, some UX stuff, some stuff to do with mobile. I can't wait to show it to you all. It's really amazing. But if you want to support Kraken like me, head over to kraken.com, which is kraken.com. Next up, BlockFi, my longest ever sponsor. An amazing team they've got over there. Love working with Zach, Flory, and Brad. The great team. We talk a lot. I'm always able to give them great feedback. And also, I got my second interest payment from my interest account, which was super cool. I can't tell you the amount because, you know, I don't want you to work out what I've got there. But it was juicy. It was nice. It was nice to get that interest back from Bitcoin that was just stuck in my wallet. And listen, if you are thinking of checking this out, you should do your own research. It's not for everyone. It is for me. But also, this week, they had another announcement. They are now supporting Gemini stablecoin GUSD with their interest accounts. Clients are eligible to earn up to 6.2% APY, and you get paid monthly with a minimum balance of $2,500. Balances over 100,000 GUSD will earn a tiered rate of 1.5% APY. listen, I'm going to check it out. I've got surplus balance in my business account. I'm just going to stick it in here, let it earn interest every month, more than I get from my current account, that's for sure. So yeah, it looks super cool. Can't wait to tell you about it. Can't wait to tell you about my experience. It'll be something I'll be sorting out this week. But if you want to check it out, you need to head over to blockfi.com, which is blockfi.com. Just going back to Ethereum. Mm-hmm. How do you think it plays out long term? You obviously have your bet. Mm-hmm. Just say you were to lose your bet. Mm-hmm. Would you at that point say, okay, there's a good argument here now that you haven't considered? Or could you lose the bet and still consider yourself as being right?
I mean, it's entirely possible I get Sybil attacked in some way, shape, or form. It's going to cost whoever Sybil attacks me a lot of money. But it's possible someone does that. So yeah, I very well could lose and have it not be detectable. And
not even a Sybil attack. Just uh-huh. Say there is some breakthrough and there's a take up of these decentralized apps. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they make sense, could you consider yourself being in the wrong, or do you think you can lose and still be in the right?
I think I can lose and still be in the right. Maybe the market was irrational for a while and, you know, a centralized service that does the exact same thing does it cheaper, better, faster. And, you know, I'm proven right ultimately. But I mean, if there are five things like that, then mad respect, right? Like maybe I was wrong and I'm very open to that possibility. I don't think I am. Yeah. But if Ethereum devs do it, then go for it. But, you know, prove me wrong, guys, right? Like that's kind of my challenge here.
How do you think Ethereum does play out though?
Yeah, the way I see things play out, like they've been trying to move to proof of stake for many years. And they like, that's always been the big argument for Ethereum is, we're not going to waste all this electricity. We're going to move to proof of stake and things like that. Right now, there's a lot of sort of fragile pieces around Ethereum. We know Infura is like what everyone uses as their full node, right? Because nobody yeah. wants to run their own. And
it's hosted on Amazon.
Yeah, and it's hosted on Amazon, and I'm told it costs Consensus a lot of money to keep it up. So in a sense, like there's multiple central points of failure, right? Like if Amazon ever bans Consensus from hosting Infura, that'll like knock off a ton of, you know, Ethereum developers from being able to develop on it. There's also, you know, Vitalik, if he decides to, you know, hard fork in some fashion that seems utterly unfair to everybody, then that might cause a giant exodus. I'm not sure. There's also regulatory central point of failure. If these ICOs or security tokens or whatever are declared, you know, illegal in some fashion, then, you know, that's a giant risk as well. There's multiple points of failure here. And my guess is that at least one of them in some way breaks. And that's the end of it. They try to revive it, but some sort of prolonged downtime or prolonged litigation or like some contentious thing that causes a lot of people to leave. Or I don't know, maybe it loses interest very slowly, but I don't see it succeeding. I really don't.
So probably a long, slow death or something catastrophic.
Yeah, well, I guess that covers just about every way it could die.
Yeah. Huh? Well, because I think about it and I just think, how can this play out and what uh-huh. might happen? And one thing I've been hoping for and waiting for is somebody at some point to turn around and go, do you know what? We were wrong. Yeah, everyone else was right who said about this. These blockchains are nonsense. Bitcoin is the only use. We were wrong. We were sorry. I'm waiting for someone to do that, and it just doesn't seem to be coming.
You gotta remember, like a lot of these guys that have created these coins and stuff, they're kind of celebrities at this point, right? Like Vitalik is known throughout the world. I mean, you look at their follower accounts; they're way more than any Bitcoin person, right? Even Andreas Antonopoulos. And part of that is, you know, they've built sort of a celebrity around being the creator of the coin, and it's. They have a not only like a financial stake in it, although Charlie claims not to, but I would also say that I own no Litecoin if I was Charlie. I would also claim that I have no Bitcoin either, right? Like just as OPSEC. But you know, they're not only financially, but there's also an emotional attachment to your creation. It's kind of like admitting that your baby's ugly. I really don't think that that's going to happen.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. All right, so if you were going to leave somebody with a final thought on blockchains, Jimmy, somebody's meeting you at an event and said, I've got a blockchain project, or I've heard about these blockchains, what would you just say as a, like a close it off? How do you close out the argument?
Well, so I would say, most of the time when people are talking about blockchains, they don't know what they're talking about. And blockchain has become sort of this blank canvas onto which you can solve anything. And generally the pattern is this. Okay, you're an industry X. You have some giant pain point, right? And somebody that knows something about blockchain says, oh, blockchain can solve that. For music, it's like, oh, make sure that the artist gets the rights or whatever. For healthcare, it's like, well, make sure that, you know, the doctor sees all of the relevant patient information without violating HIPAA at the exact right time without any loss of privacy and, complying with all the laws and all that stuff. Or you might be a lawyer and it's like, well, you can look up, you can make a perfect smart contract that will execute everything at the exact right time with the right decisions, and you know, you don't have to litigate anymore or something. You know, it's always like, let's take the biggest problem and the biggest costs and let's remove them. Doesn't that sound like it's a little too good to be true, right? Like, I mean, how can one technology that's made to be purposefully kind of slow, hard to upgrade, and very distributed, it's supposed to be decentralized, how can that solve all of those problems, right? Shouldn't you be just at least a little bit skeptical, right? Like, this is exactly what snake oil salesmen used to do. Oh, it'll cure your cough, it'll cure your syphilis, it'll cure your nosebleed, whatever. Like, whatever ailment you had, somehow snake oil would solve it. And that's kind of the word blockchain has taken on. Whatever problem you happen to have in your particular industry, it's going to be solved with blockchain. You should be skeptical of claims like that, and you shouldn't take it. You shouldn't be taken in by these hucksters. That's what I would say.
All right. Well, we've got two other things we can talk about today. I'm going to let you choose. We can talk about toxicity in Bitcoin, because that's been talked about a lot recently. Or we can talk about Craig Wright.
Oh, we got to talk about Craig Wright, because it involves you, and I'm as curious as everybody else.
All right, okay. So obviously, I put out a tweet today just to explain the update on the legal situation. So I've spoken to lawyers, and I'm in a position whereby if I don't have pro bono support, that to file the initial defense will cost anything up to £50,000.
Wow. Just the initial defense.
Uh-huh. And then if we don't go through mediation and agree some form of compromise or agreement, if it went through as a full defamation case, then the cost could be anything up to £500,000 to £750,000. And then if you lose, it's £1.5 million because you have to cover their costs. So there's options. So option one is don't contest it. And if you don't contest it, I'll be subject to the $100,000, possibly a bit more, to legal fees. And I'll have a default judgment against me that will probably say I can no longer call Craig Wright a fraud and a liar. So there's that. The benefit to doing that is he doesn't have his day in court and doesn't get to say, oh, look, a judge agreed we are Satoshi, even though that wouldn't be proven. The second one is to represent yourself, which does come with a number of benefits in that you save costs, but also you are able to speak directly to a judge and just highlight how you're being bullied and intimidated by billionaires. The third one is have counsel to support it. But anyway, so right now it's just a number of choices. I'm going to fight it. I'm not going to walk away. It's just a number of choices to do it and just figuring it out. So yeah, that's where we're at, man.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like, I guess this is why people bring libel suits and things like that. It's sort of upping the stakes. And if you don't have nuclear weapons at your disposal, it's kind of hard to fight back.
Yeah, and we don't really have good freedom of speech laws in the UK. Mm. It's one of the things I do admire about the US now, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, so tell us what that actually means.
So the burden of proof is reversed in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So if this lawsuit was in the US, Craig Wright would have to prove he is Satoshi mm-hmm. to win the case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whereas in the UK, for me to win the case, I have to prove he isn't. I don't think it's binary. I think it's more of a burden of proof.
Uh-huh.
And I think we have enough evidence
yeah.
there. I mean, I was talking to somebody this morning and they said, well, there is nobody in this industry who has been proven as a liar and a con man more times than this person. You know, he tricked Gavin potentially. I mean, I don't know what happened there. I also turned around to them early on. And I said, because they're suing me for 100,000. I mm-hmm. said, I'll sell everything I own. Mm-hmm. I probably can pull together 250,000. I'll give you that if you just sign a message with Satoshi's keys.
Yeah, or you send $1 worth of Bitcoin. Yeah. And that is very compelling. I mean, so I'm not sure how a judge would react to something like that. Like, how do they use information like that?
I don't know. I mean, I've not been in this position, but, you know, if you want the world to believe you are Satoshi,
uh-huh.
okay, you want the world to believe that because you want to push your technology and mm-hmm. your agenda forward. And you also want to win a case mm-hmm. where somebody's defaming you, and that person's turning around saying, do the one thing mm-hmm. that we know would certainly give a lot of credence to your claim, sign it. Uh-huh. Not only are you going to prove to the world what you're trying to say, and you're going to get a higher payout that you want in the court, and you're going to get everything you want.
Right.
So why wouldn't you do it?
So that's a credibility thing. So I mean, for the audience and for my benefit, what is the statement that he claims is libelous? Is it Craig S. Wright is a fraud or Craig S. Wright is not Satoshi? Because those are both different, right?
Yeah, it's both.
Okay. So you'd have to prove the opposite for both?
Yes, but they're kind of tied, aren't they?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But the fraud thing's quite broad because obviously he's had various other legal situations. So he had with the Australian Tax Office
uh-huh.
where he made his claim based on having some supercomputer. I can't remember the full details right now. And
He also claimed to have a doctorate from a university, and the university came out and said, no, you don't. So, I mean, that would probably is a slam dunk on the fraud thing, because if you're misrepresenting yourself, that's pretty much fraud.
Yeah.
But the other one is not Satoshi. That seems a little harder.
Well, it's harder because you're trying to prove a negative. But uh-huh. I think, you know, if you're talking about reasonable doubt,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been bookmarking everything and I've got mm-hmm. hundreds of articles and situations where he has consistently proved himself either as a liar uh-huh. or unable to provide the proof that people want that he is Satoshi.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just sign the keys? I still don't understand. What's the argument not to sign the keys?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I don't know. I kind of wish I knew. I guess he could argue something like, well, I lost them or something. And there's no way you can prove that I didn't or something like that.
But he's never claimed that he's lost them. That would be suddenly convenient.
Yeah. The fact that he like went back and edited his old blog post, that to me is just... Man, just all the like cringy things that he does, right? Like the fake signature article that I wrote about a while mm-hmm. back. It's just so obvious that he's trying so hard to prove something, or get some, or deceive enough people or something like that.
Well, I think the worrying thing about it all is there was a couple of things. Is obviously the you know, abuse of the court system uh-huh. and the bullying and intimidation. I think we need a better system to not allow this. One thing I read quite concerning recently is, you know, he registered this copyright.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think that's related to this case?
I think everything's related.
Okay.
I think it makes me laugh how consistently amateur it is, though. You know, Calvin Ayer comes out and says, oh, we've got another piece of great evidence that Craig is Satoshi that we'll be releasing this week. He releases the fact that he registered the copyright. And then everyone comes in and said, well, anyone can do this.
Uh-huh.
Anyone can register it.
Uh-huh.
And also he paid $800 to get it expedited. And uh-huh. then we had a statement from the copyright office uh-huh. saying, we don't investigate these.
Uh-huh.
So again, it was so amateur. But there was another article that came out that said that he will be pursuing people who misuse the copyright. And what I think is concerning is here, could he go to Coinbase and Kraken and sue them for using his copyrighted Bitcoin? What's that scenario?
It's a good question. I mean, maybe they can sort of gang up and come to the UK. Maybe he sues blockchain.info. I think they're based in the UK, so maybe they can come to your defense with them and maybe split the cost or something. I don't know.
See, this is the problem. It's so obvious that he's operating some form of long con. Uh-huh. It's so obvious that he isn't Satoshi. He can't code. His moronic ideas around what Bitcoin should be, that it's government friendly, enterprise friendly, which is completely antithetical to everything I've learned about Bitcoin. Yet, by having deep pockets or having the support of Calvin Ayres' deep pockets, he can intimidate and bully people.
Yeah, isn't that so frustrating that we still, like, despite all of the, ideals about democracy or whatever, we really still kind of live in an oligarchy. You know, the people that have the money get to set the rules or get a tremendous advantage over those that don't. And that's kind of what I'm hoping Bitcoin changes. But unfortunately, the systems are set up so that the rich people always have their thumb on the scales.
Well, actually, kind of relevant to what we spoke about earlier, because what they are pushing with their Bitcoin Satoshi's vision is the gigameg blocks. I mean, we've talked about this already. What is the problem of having a gigabyte block?
Oh, well, I mean,
is it doable?
Well, can you transmit a gigabyte? Yes. Is it good for the network? Absolutely not. They already had the very large block that that caused the fork very, very quickly.
It's just because it can't propagate quick enough.
Yeah, and you need the 10 minutes in order for, you know, stuff to propagate. And once it's propagated, then you can, you know, make sure that every node can check it. And if it doesn't meet the requirements of consensus, then it needs to get rejected. But if every node, you know, if nodes can't really do that, then it's a problem. And you know, you end up, especially like with something so large, just the bandwidth requirements to go from one node to another, given the current bandwidth speeds, just doesn't work. So, I mean, this, but, you know, their position has been, you know, you don't really need more than 6 nodes in the world or something ridiculous like that. So,
do you think there's any chance Satoshi himself could have screwed up and gone with on-chain scaling and believe so?
Yeah, I don't think what Satoshi thought really matters at this point. I mean, we have the Bitcoin we have now, and we know the limitations that it has right now. And we know what bandwidth we have right now. Who knows? Maybe there's a fast fiber optic technology that can be laid over underground that's really quick. And, you know, we have like terabit speeds tomorrow, in which case, yeah, maybe we can do something that's kind of a soft fork that increases block size on chain. I don't know. Point is, we're from an engineering perspective, we've optimized pretty well on where things are. But even that might not be exactly the optimum. I mean, Luke Dash Jr. thinks that block should be smaller, just given all of the different restrictions that we have with hardware and things like that. But, you know, those things can improve, and it's possible in the future we might be able to do something, but that's not a conversation we need to have right now, because things are always changing and people tend to sort of project linearly, and that's exactly the wrong way to think when you're thinking about technological improvements. It's almost always like orders of magnitude improvements with some interesting technology nobody thought to apply. And that's where innovation happens.
Yeah. It'd be great to finish up just to find a little bit about your book as well, because we talked about it the other day, because you've gone through the process of writing a book. And there's quite an interesting story behind that where you were saying about concentration. So what was the background to writing the book and just how much work went into it?
Yeah. So I started the book, I think, December of 2017, right at the height of the bubble. And that was when I think I completed the, you know, I signed the contract with O'Reilly. And I had an editor that was keeping me accountable. She really kicked my ass, right? Like, and I tried to write at least a little bit, like a paragraph a night or something, but then there was like a whole month where I just didn't do anything. And, you know, she would just be like, Jimmy, what's going on? You know, come on, like you need to write more. Eventually, I went on that cruise That cruise. And
I always call that the ugly old goat cruise. Yeah,
it was an interesting cruise, and ugly old goat was indeed there. But basically, I stayed in my room that whole time and just wrote and called room service for coffee and tea. I think I went out of the room once a day to go to the steak restaurant and ate steak with my friends, and then came back and wrote some more. Like, that's pretty much all I did. I got a significant amount of work done during that cruise. I think I wrote like 4 or 5 chapters while doing that. So it is possible to get it done. The hard thing is sort of time boxing it. And as most writers have told me, it's not the writing that's hard. It's sitting down to write that's hard, yeah. Right? It's like sort of forcing yourself and getting started on the process, and like being willing to stare at a blank page and feel terrible that you haven't written anything, and like just sort of motivating yourself to get it done. That's the hard part. But if you can get there and you do, accomplish something, it's kind of nice. I don't know. There's a definite sense of accomplishment about it. So highly recommend it. If you can manage, but it's not for everyone.
What was that story though you were telling me about, that you have that thing where you get buddy?
Yeah, focus me.
The focus buddy.
Yeah. So after the cruise, I still needed to complete like 4 or 5 more chapters. So what I ended up using was a website called FocusMate. And basically it's a very simple idea. You book like an hour slot, and you have to have a webcam. And there's somebody on the other side. They need to get work done too. At the beginning of the hour, you just tell each other what you're going to work on. And at the end of the hour, you just ask, how much progress did you make on what you said? So it kind of forces you to get started, right? It's that process of looking at a blank page and doing something. And it's an efficient way to time box. And that website definitely worked for me. I used it for like a good month and a half. And the people on the other side, it was interesting. There were a lot of a lot of other people that were also writing books, but there were also like grad students writing their dissertation. There were, people that were coding. There were people that were trying to knock out a newsletter or something like that. But yeah, it definitely worked for me.
Is it not weird at all?
It is a little weird because, like you see their face on the screen and you're supposed to be watching them too. But, you just see their eyes just like kind of glancing down at their keyboard and back up, like you would expect someone working at a computer. But yeah, it was pretty effective.
So what's the book called?
Programming Bitcoin. My publisher is O'Reilly. It's available on Amazon. I think it's currently like $40.
Okay. Yeah. And when are you doing programming Ethereum?
Not going to happen. Programming Wallet would be the next one if I wrote another one.
But this is for anyone who wants to get into programming Bitcoin. Do you have to be intermediate level? Is it beginner?
Yeah, so you have to know some Python.
Okay.
But once you know Python, that's all you have to know. You don't have to know anything about Bitcoin. The book teaches you all the math you need, all of the, digital signature algorithm, transaction construction, and blocks and verification and network programming. All of that is covered.
Cool. What else is coming up for you, Jimmy?
Well, I am going to be at Breaking Bitcoin in Amsterdam. Yep. I'll be at Bitcoin 2019 in San Francisco. I'll be doing BitBlock Boom in Dallas in August, and Scaling Bitcoin in September, and
Honey Badger
in Riga. Yeah.
So I think I'm doing all but one of them, maybe okay. Two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll be seeing you a lot of you.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to look more and more weathered though.
Yeah.
It's just legal situation.
Well, it is really cold here, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And like, I love the sunlight. Like sunset is like at 11:30, but
And then it starts getting light at 3.
Yeah. So there's like, it's surreal, but it's actually like, it's late May and it is cold.
This is like October for me, so
yeah.
This doesn't matter. I'm used to that. I still came out in a t-shirt today. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. It's still a little, well, me being from Austin, it's a little odd.
Yeah. Yeah, do you know what? I was again in Austin again recently. I'm really starting to enjoy that place. Like, love it.
Yeah, it's a great, great area.
I went for, where did I go for barbecue? I went to a place just outside
Franklin's.
It was La Barbecue. Got a huge pit.
Oh, that might be.
But it was about a 20-minute drive out.
Oh, that's the one in Dripping Springs. Why can't I remember the name? Yeah, I know what you're talking
about. But Austin's got a really vibrant scene now, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. Especially barbecue. Yeah.
Barbecue and Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what we do sometimes. Like, I get a bunch of Bitcoiners together and we just eat meat and talk about Bitcoin.
Well, we did that. I did that with you.
That was at the steak restaurant.
Yeah, at the Tomahawk.
Yeah, yeah. But we do it at people's houses and, like, everyone brings their own ribeye and, you know, you're eating ribeye and talk. I mean, like, what could be better than eating ribeye and talking about Bitcoin? Yeah.
Did I ever tell you the story when I stopped? I was a vegetarian when I stopped.
No way.
So it's to do with the podcast. Uh-huh. I've told it before. So if anyone's listening, heard it, I'm sorry. But so my third episode was with Jameson Lopp.
Okay.
And I emailed him and said, I want to do this interview. And he said, yeah. I said, can I come out and do it with you in America? And can you take me to shoot a gun? Uh-huh. I'd never shot a gun. He was like, yeah. So anyway, I get to his house and there's guns everywhere. He's got them all out,
he's a gun nut. Yeah.
Well, that's the first time I'd seen the guns. And I was a vegetarian, almost vegan at the time. Uh-huh. Anyway, so we do this interview. We got the guns in the car and he's like, oh, we're going to go for lunch. And he takes me to this like barbecue hut. And I was like, I didn't have the guts to turn around and say, I'm a vegetarian. So yeah, I ate meat and that's the day I stopped.
Oh, wow.
So it is Bitcoin.
Anyway. That's cool stuff. I actually used to be vegetarian, but I stopped like 7-8 years ago. So it's
It was good for me actually. I did the vegan the time when I did a whole year of vegan with my mum when she was sick, and I would say it's probably the best I felt. I felt really healthy. I was really fit. Felt really good.
Have you tried carnivory?
Not full.
Try that for a month and see, because I think the best I felt as a vegetarian was when I did the raw diet for a month.
Okay.
So that was interesting because nothing cooked above a certain temperature and I had this mental clarity. I felt very similar with the carnivore diet, which was kind of surprising.
But you only eat once a day, right?
So usually once or twice a day at the most. Yeah. I ate twice yesterday because, you know, we had the dinner thing. And then, oh my goodness, the breakfast buffet here is amazing.
Is it? Like, I've missed it every day.
Oh, God. Oh, no way.
No, don't.
So there's like all this, we're in Norway. So they have all this like smoked salmon and like dried salmon. But they also have like dried beef. Like bacon. They had liver pate, which I usually hate, but this actually tasted really good. And the eggs are really good quality, and you could tell because the egg yolks are like super yellow. They have a lot of nutrients and stuff. I was just like gorging on like meat, cheese, salmon, like liver. I think it's like one of the most nutritious meals I could have had, wow. Right? Because you get omega-3s and, like all the different stuff from the organ meat and stuff like it was really good.
Did you get your whale meat?
I haven't. I want to try whale steak, but everyone kind of looks at me weird when I say I want some whale steak.
Because we prefer some animals over others, right?
Oh, yeah. They do look cute.
All right, Jim. Well, look, this was great. Great to have you back on. Appreciate it. And yeah, I guess I'm going to see you all year.
Yeah. Might be doing more of these. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. So how was that? What do you make of that? Are you new to crypto or are you an old school Bitcoiner? Do you get this? Are you tempted by other projects? Are you interested in other projects? Or do you just understand that all these blockchains might just be nonsense? I don't know. Did this interview help you in understanding why investing in other blockchains may be risky? Maybe you should just stick your money in Bitcoin. Look, I've tried to keep an open mind in the past, but I've increasingly struggled with these other projects. Are there any value in other cryptocurrencies? What about these blockchains that seem to be putting loads of information on the blockchain? Ethereum, is it nonsense? EOS, is it nonsense? I kind of have a soft spot for Monero. I don't own any anymore, but I kind of have a soft spot for it. But like, is Ethereum going down some crazy route trying to put all this data on the blockchain? Having a chat with Jimmy, I'm not convinced. I think
possibly. Bitcoin's the one for me. Perhaps this blockchain myth has been perpetuated by people wanting to sell nonsense. But it's definitely interesting. Love talking to Jimmy. I hope you enjoy the interview. You know, if you've got any questions, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And if you do want to support the show, there's so many things you can do. It's all on my website. Just head over to whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section. You can listen to the ads, you can become a sponsor, you can become a patron, you can just leave me a review on iTunes or click on the subscribe button. Whatever you do, it all helps with the show, all helps with me keeping this going. Anyway, I'm going to be heading back to London tomorrow. I need a couple of weeks off. I miss my kids. I hope they miss me. It's kind of tough being away all the time because, yeah, I do miss them. But yeah, I'm going to be having a couple of weeks back at home, and then I'm going to be heading back out stateside. I've got some really cool interviews planned, a couple of confirmed, which are really quite exciting. I can't tell you about it now, but yeah, I can't wait to show you those. And I also want to give a massive thanks out there to Alex Gladstein for his invite to the Oslo Freedom Forum, which was definitely a life-changing experience for me. I'll probably talk about that some more another day. And also, I just want to give a big thanks to Daniel, who invited me out here in Munich for the Lightning Hack Day and the Value of Bitcoin Conference. And remember, if you've got any questions, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.